Hello and welcome to a podcast where we take fictional science from comics, movies, TV, etc. and try to make it factually, scientifically, possibly real. I'm Stoby.
I am known as Forgan.
And I'm Stu.
And this is The Science of Fiction.
Pick up the tricorder, put it on your head. Scanning the planet, see if anyone is dead. Autonomous car driving in Zanzibar. Beam me up, Scotty, I'm not that far. Android hoovering, tearing up the place. Flip phones and conference calls, friends in outer space. Astrophysicist sitting on my knee. Asking aliens if they like it.
Our science of fiction. To the science of fiction. I've got an addiction. To the science of fiction. I've got an addiction, baby. To the science of fiction. I've got an addiction. To the science of fiction.
We are back.
Once again with the Renegade Master.
No. Yeah.
Someone out there will get that.
Yeah. Right. Hopefully. How's it going, folks?
Pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Stu, how's it going?
I'm surviving. I'm still alive.
Yeah, you guys have been busy since we were last releasing an episode.
Yeah.
I have been translocated literally 350 miles.
Translocated? It sounds like you've warped here.
It feels like it. Given what we've had talked about in the past, it feels like it. The stress has been on my body.
Did you get spaghettified?
I genuinely feel spaghettified. Lasagna'd, penne pasta, the whole thing.
Ravioli'd.
I'm hungry now.
Tiny little packages.
I'm glad we ate before we started recording. I thought I would have been hungry now too. Oh, so it's been a while. So when did the last episode come out? Or season one.
In a time long forgotten.
You mean like March?
Yeah.
I don't remember yesterday. Most days.
So, like that film that's out?
That movie, the thing that happened. I don't remember.
Anything about it at all?
No, nothing at all.
No. This is going to be good for the podcast if you can't remember films.
This is what the internet's for.
I just like the fact that all this trouble seems so far away. So, yeah, we are back. Season two.
And we're in the room. We're actually in the room at the same time.
We're in a room. Not the room.
Okay, yeah. We're in... A room.
Yes.
It is the room.
We are co-located.
So what you're saying is any room that we're all in is the room to be
exactly.
in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. That bodes well for later on.
Yeah.
When there'll be other people in the room, but we'll keep that for later.
That'll be in 10 weeks' time, folks.
Massive spoiler alert. As
well. Genuinely, I didn't think someone could facial express maths, but
the joys of being in the room.
Yes,
at Light Press Studios in Perth for all your media and design needs, and they are the host of our website as well.
Yes, not the first time we've been here. We've done a couple of recordings here.
We have indeed.
So those fancy pictures that we had taken.
Yeah, those good pictures. So big shout out to Ian and Light Press. Thanks for the room. So season two. We get into that, the last time we were all in a room together, what was that for? We were all in the same location.
Yeah. I know, but I still remember.
Yeah.
Genuinely. I'm sitting there going, don't have any memory.
It was a little do.
Oh, yeah, you did a book.
Yes.
So, we are sitting with Dr. Duncan Forgan, author.
Published.
That's right.
Book available on Amazon and other book depositories.
So, tell us about Solving Fermi's Paradox.
Yeah, so Solving Fermi's Paradox is a book I've been writing since 2015. It's finally out on the shelves.
No spoilers.
There's no spoilers. You have to buy the book.
Just pure teasers.
So it's all about the search for intelligent life and all the things that we need to think about if we want to actually go and look for things like humans that live on other planets. So you can buy it, as Stu said, from Amazon or any other reputable book depository. It's published by Cambridge University Press. It's only in hardback at the minute, so it's reasonably priced.
I know the price point. Yeah. I'm not going to say it because that'd be crass.
Yes.
No cheap plugs for you.
And it might have changed by the time.
This is true. By the time this comes out to...
There were also discounts when it first came out. I remember that.
That's true. Yeah. So there was a few discounts on it. But it was selling reasonably well last time I checked. But Yeah, if you're interested, it's online now.
In the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
That's right.
I'm just going to stick closer to home and keep looking.
None in this house.
So, End of the World season, episode one. What are we talking about today?
We are talking Armageddon off the planet, as the Australians would put it when the end of the world comes. Because I've always had these questions. Obviously, you see a lot in these movies, these big, huge disaster movies, when you've got comets coming out of out of space and everything's going to blow up, and then they send oil drillers to, rather than astronauts, to put a hole in an astronaut to save us all.
Put a hole in an astronaut.
Let's put a hole in the comet and leave the astronaut untouched, okay?
The real problem is the people. Let's kill the people first.
To be honest, sending up oil drillers rather than astronauts does seem like a pretty poor plan in the best of states. Let's face it, Michael Bay movies and reality have a very tenuous grasp.
Yes, there's a long way between.
Weirdly, their Venn diagram doesn't really touch.
Yeah. But they send Michael Clark Duncan up. Surely he can just like punch that asteroid and be done with.
I'm sure Forgan could do some math and prove that wrong.
Ooh. Yeah. How hard would he have to slap it?
Now, a 1,000-kilometer asteroid like the one in Armageddon bigger than a chicken. Right? I could start by saying
if there was a 1,000-kilometer chicken coming at Earth. I think the fact that
even a 1 kilometer chicken, let's just scale this back.
I think there would be more questions. I think first of all, you'd have solved the paradox.
Yes, there'd be life on other planets. Like, yeah, okay. Apparently, they're bloody massive chickens, but okay.
Either that, or we'd be playing a massive celestial game of Angry Birds.
Well, maybe. I mean, who knows?
That could be. We could just be sitting on an unstable wooden pile waiting for a giant chicken to hit us.
Are you saying we're a bunch of big green pigs?
No, I'm just saying that
pink ones.
So God. You see these movies and they just demonstrate all these high drama moments where the world is going to end.
Yeah.
But I mean, how close to reality is it? In reality, if something like that were to happen or about to happen, how realistic is it? And what are our options? Because I'm expecting it's probably a high top secret. There would be some plans, but let's face it, sometimes you see these things and you go, I mean, is that really an answer to this situation? And if we do have to evacuate the Earth, what are we going to do? Right. Like, there's no fire exit, there's no fire marshal waiting for the alarm to go off and be like, everybody leave your desks, leave your phone, it's not important.
Leave your phone going.
Yeah, you're going to get a reception. You make everyone go out and go to the muster point.
Yes.
Well, it's raining outside, also there's no atmosphere.
Well, so can I start by like saying how bad Armageddon is scientifically?
Really? No. Oh, I mean, wow, there's a surprise.
This is not new information.
No,
right?
I mean, I expected more from you, to be perfectly honest, as a published scientist.
So the biggest problem with that film, and it's the problem that makes all
the
other
dialogue,
problems,
isn't it? It's absolutely
the dialogue. It's Ben Affleck.
Okay. One of the biggest problems in terms of like the plot is that the asteroid that's heading for the Earth is I think they say it's the size of Texas.
The description is the size of Texas.
Okay, so it's like of order 1,000 kilometers across, right? That is bloody massive, right? And it's probably the case that, okay, let me just look in my brain for typical sizes. So we have these things called dwarf planets in the solar system, so things that aren't quite planets. Oh, wow, okay. Yeah, so if Texas is about 1,700 kilometers across, thanks, dude. So yeah, you're talking like something that's 1,000 kilometers across. You know, some of the bodies in the solar system that we regard as planets are like 500 kilometers across. So this isn't getting hit by an asteroid. We're getting hit by, like, basically a small planet.
When we say across, are you meaning, like, sort of, is it radius in a sphere?
So yeah,
or,
500 radius, which makes it 1,000 across. Right, yeah. Right? So you're talking, like, a dwarf planet like Ceres, which is between Mars and Jupiter, is about 500 kilometers, I believe. So, yeah, you're getting hit by a planet, not by an asteroid. And really, there is nothing we can do to stop this, right? If you send a bunch of guys to drill and fire off a nuke, you know, you think, oh, I'm going to try and drill to the core. You're not. You're going to basically drill like a little bit under the skin and then set off a little whiz bang. And nothing's going to happen, right?
See, this is my other sort of query. It's like, I mean, first of all, we don't know. You couldn't be able to tell what that asteroid is made of, surely.
You would have a good guess, because we'd know quite a lot about what asteroids are made of typically, right? So if it belongs to the solar system, we can categorize it into like the C category, which means it's made of lots of carbon-based compounds, or the S category, which is like silicates and metals and stuff. So we can say, okay, it's probably mostly these things. And we know that asteroids are kind of leftovers from building the solar system, so whatever the planets are made of, any of the sort of remnant stuff is going to be made of similar things.
So leftover Lego bricks, basically.
Basically, yeah. So you're talking, you know, bits of rock that are similar-ish in composition to the planets in the solar system. So you're talking like silicate rock, carbonaceous rocks. Fine, right? So if they were small enough, yeah, you could probably send somebody to deploy a nuclear device, you know, far enough in that if you blew it up, then maybe the pieces are small enough so that if they did come into contact with the Earth's atmosphere, they burn up and everything's hunky-dory.
Okay. Right. But so then the next part of this plan in this situation is drill down 800 feet.
On a 1,000-kilometer asteroid.
On a 1,000-kilometer asteroid.
Yeah.
Plant a nuclear bomb.
Oh, yeah.
It's an H-bomb, specifically an H-bomb. And then detonate it. Mm-hmm. And obviously it gets more dramatic in the movie because things happen and all that sort of stuff. But if we just look at the actual plan, 800 feet, which is nothing.
Yes.
Down into, essentially, almost like a fingernail.
Yes.
Like, you go as deep as a fingernail into this massive celestial body.
Yeah.
You plant it literally just says a nuclear bomb. Doesn't say thermonuclear, doesn't say anything like that. And then you blow it up.
Yeah.
And now, when you do that, mm-hmm. at the very edge of this 1,000-odd feet across asteroid, mm-hmm. how they can't guarantee it's going to split the way they expect it to.
No, they can't because it won't.
Yeah. But did they not say in the film it was on a fault line or something like that?
Yeah, I think they say something.
They say it fractures.
That's fortuitous. But to be able to put on a fault line down 800 feet and expect that fault line to shatter the entire thing.
Again, to kind of extend the argument back, right? Do you think you could blow up the Earth by putting a nuclear bomb down a fault line? How big would that bomb have to be?
See, that's another question for another day.
Because I do
have that question for something else, but we'll keep that in mind.
Okay, right.
Because I genuinely have investigated that.
So yeah, even if there's some kind of like, you know, specific fault in the asteroid, and you know, they might get really lucky, and it might be the case that if it was maybe like a 100-kilometer body, that yeah, maybe this is possible, that you could find a bit where, you know, when asteroids are formed, they kind of come together, you know. You might have a 25-kilometer and a 30-kilometer, they smash together, and they smash into bits, and then the bits kind of orbit each other and reassemble into what they call a rubble pile. And that, over time, will start to kind of order itself under gravity and start to collapse and form something solid. So maybe the nature, the history of this object is such that actually, yeah, there is like a point where if you hit it with something that doesn't need to be a lot of force, you can split it in two, right? And we've seen bodies in the solar system that look like that. There was a distant object that the New Horizons probe went past, Ultima Thule, and it looks a bit like, you know, a snowball attached to a minstrel, right? There's two different bits. One bit's very disky, one bit's very round.
When you say minstrel, you mean like the chocolate, not like a man playing a lute.
Oh, yes, the chocolate minstrel, right? Yes, okay. Yeah. It doesn't look like a man. Well, the thing is, when they looked at it one side on, it looked like a snowman because they could just see like two circles. And they're like, oh, it looks like a snowman. And then they saw it from the other side and went, oh, like the bit at the bottom's actually really flat. It's too sort of more two-dimensional. So you can imagine, like, yeah, I'll stick a bomb like at the bit where these two bits meet, and maybe because of the fact that they're not very well joined, maybe I can split them apart. You might get lucky. But this thing is still the size of a planet, right?
Yeah.
So Armageddon is not going to be able to use this particular technique. It's just never going to work.
I just want to double check, because like it says, I'm just checking the, going back into the thing, it says Texas size surface rather than across. I don't know if that changes the calculations in your head. And it's still big.
Okay, so if you're saying it's a surface area of Texas.
It says a surface area, and I think Texas's area is... Sorry, I'm just going to quickly jump to the thing. Area is 268,581 square miles.
Okay.
Or 696,281 kilometers.
So if it's going to be... Say it's 2,000 square kilometers, just to... Oh, sorry, yeah, 2,000... Is it... across how many square?
That's the surface. That's the area of...
Okay, so it's that many square kilometers. You divide, so the surface area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared, so divide that by about 12, so divide by about 10, so that's like 70,000 square root of that. Okay, it's still bloody massive.
Yeah, still bloody massive. Okay, so, right. I just it's still way bigger than... Just in case there's anyone on the internet who's suddenly sitting there going, hey, got the size of the because no one in the world of the internet has ever nitpicked on some sort of detail like that. So I just wanted to cover us.
And I've never had an email to that effect.
No, so, never. Yeah. So, say the plan goes ahead, and we've managed to split the fault line, and it splits into two. Yeah. Now you have two half the size... surface area of Texas celestial bodies, which we've already established are bigger than asteroids,
yes,
about to pass the Earth.
Well, are they going to pass the Earth?
Yeah, again, is it going to change the trajectory enough that both are going to miss? Mm. Because now you've got two gigantic things about to hit it.
Yeah.
And second of all, even if it misses or grazes it, or passes with a point where it's going to affect the atmosphere, it's going to do something.
Well, it's like what The Rock says. He says, if I hit you, it's going to hurt. But if I miss you, the wind from my fist is going to give you pneumonia and you're still going to fall over.
Exactly.
So it must be quite a drag comes off these things.
So, okay. So as a rule of thumb, if the Earth gets hit by anything bigger than about a kilometre in size, that puts like human civilization at extreme risk. Okay. So we now have two objects that are way bigger than a kilometre in size. And yeah, even if they brush the Earth, what we call Earth grazing, like the friction that you generate by just passing through the Earth's atmosphere and coming out the other side, I mean, yeah, what you're basically describing is very large nuclear explosions happening in the atmosphere.
Wow.
So, like, very large. And we've had examples in the past where much smaller objects that are like tens of metres... coming into the Earth's atmosphere, and as they come in, they're kind of getting broken up by the friction, and eventually the whole thing just explodes. Mm. And these things are like giant nuclear detonations in the atmosphere. So Tunguska in the Siberian tundra was one of the most famous examples, and it just destroyed huge sections of forest. It was really lucky it was in basically
the middle of nowhere.
A very unpopulated area. If that happened in an urban region, then you're talking basically like a Hiroshima-style event or worse. You know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people dead.
And what would be released into the atmosphere? Like, we know from nuclear bomb, you get the nuclear fallout, the radiation, things like that. Would there be similar sort of effects from this? It would, like, it's not just the force of a nuclear bomb, it's the effects of a nuclear bomb as well.
Well, it's the energy, right? So you're concentrating huge amounts of energy into a small place, and so all the atoms in that bit are just getting... bombarded with this energy. So you do get all the same kind of products. So you get the same production of radioactive dust. You get the same radiation, the gamma rays and all that. That's all going to start coming out of the site of where this thing is grazing us. It's not clear how much of the asteroid itself is going to break off during the explosion. So you might get rained on by all sorts of extra stuff that's, anything bigger than a football, basically, is going to hit the Earth. Mm. So where that's coming along, you're going to disrupt the asteroid itself and break off bits. It might, due to the force of what is going to be a much bigger explosion than the pea shooter we shot at it, to split it into, much, much bigger, then that could actually break huge chunks off, and you could have a much worse situation where we're getting, 100-meter bodies slamming into our surface at the kind of speed they would have been starting at. So, yeah. Wherever that is, that's pretty bad.
Yeah. Armageddon didn't have as happy an ending as we were presented.
No.
Ben Affleck and Liv Tyler got that one kiss and then everybody died.
Ben Affleck.
Because of the kiss or because of the asteroid?
Probably both, I would imagine.
Going back to what you were talking about with the astronauts and the oil drillers.
Yeah.
At the time, Ben Affleck actually mentioned that to Michael Bay. He's like, why are we training oil drillers to be astronauts and why not? And he was basically told to just shut the up.
Yeah.
That was it. He was just told, shut up, it's my film.
Yeah. I mean, do you know what? Like, films are films, and if you want to suspend your disbelief and just follow along with the fantasy, that's fine. You just shouldn't represent this as being anywhere near realistic.
But this is the thing. Like, I'm not necessarily... Like, we're not going to get into a review of Armageddon. Like, Armageddon is a popcorn flick.
I mean, it's been 23 years. I think it's time.
23 years.
What, for an asteroid?
As like, we're done, just wipe us out.
I enjoy it as a turn your brain off sort of thing. It's got some great moments in it. But like, yeah, there's certain moments where you actually look at it, and this is again what we do in this podcast. We look at the science of fiction.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you actually investigate it, you go, I don't think that works as well as you think it does.
Yeah. Yeah, the space shuttle's flying like fighter jets. That, yeah. Even as a as a relatively precocious teenager, I was like, nah.
Sure. Whereas I was just like, this is so cool. I mean, is he pleased?
So, I mean, that's one example of a disaster movie where maybe everything's a little bit more rose-tinted. Afterwards, at the end, it's like, oh, yeah, we're fine. Mm. No, we're not.
What's up, Fair City Podcast? This is Chris and Dan from Fresh Talk. Check us out at freshtalkpodcast.com.
That's right. And if you had any idea how long it took me and Dan to do that bumper, you would actually probably never listen to us.
It's totally true. Get him, Stobie.
Hey, Stobie, it's me, Jarrett. Go to JarrettGoesToTheMovies.com. Check out the podcast. Also go to Rockstar Dad Show. Check that one out, too. It's freaking great. They're both great. Also, you just got a text and a Facebook message.
Yeah.
And I probably better give you this phone back.
Hello, this is Jim.
And my name is Graham Chenjack.
And we're both responsible for the monstrosity that is A Bloody Mess Podcast.
We can be found at www.facebook.com/messpodcast, twitter.com/mess_podcast, Instagram is A Bloody Mess.
And we're our alternative Wednesdays to the Science of Fiction Podcast, which is a must listen.
The other one that I think is a really good example is Deep Impact.
Yes.
But in Deep Impact, it sort of goes a different way because we take the hit.
Yeah, we do.
And basically the major solution that the world has is put a whole bunch of people in underground bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not the same scale of
how big was the asteroid in that film? Or was it a comet?
It says...
A comet is hurtling toward Earth and could mean the end of all human life.
It is 7 miles long.
Seven miles.
And large enough to cause a mass extinction.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's true. If it's 7 miles long, it is large enough to cause a mass extinction.
But later on, they do a similar plan in the movie to Armageddon.
Uh-huh.
Strange parallel production, who knew?
Yeah,
it's funny, isn't it? They came out at the same time, didn't they?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. There's a whole...
This happens
about
a lot, though, like with films. Two films with the same thing suddenly come out at the same time, like 2012 and Day After Tomorrow.
Parallel production, mm-hmm, and parallel producing. Yeah. There's a great video by Lindsay Ellis on it. I would recommend people to have a look at from back in the day. But anyway, you go back into they go on in the movie and they essentially the same thing. They blow up the asteroid, but they get a smaller one which is still going to connect.
Yeah.
At that point, you have two, which is one is 1.5 miles long and one is 6 miles long.
Right, okay.
And it looks like both of them still hit.
They both hit. I thought only one hit. It's been such a long time since I've seen that film, I can't remember.
Let me have a look. Sorry, I'm still having
a... That's break. Okay. No, I mean, my question kind of leads from that anyway is... Ignoring humanity and civilization and the buildings and things like that, just looking at the planet as an object, something this size hits one bit of the planet, what physically happens to the planet? I mean, does it just... I'm assuming there's a ripple effect goes out from it and it's destructive, but I mean, how...
So let's assume that the big bit hits, right? So which was 6 miles across?
6 miles across.
Okay, so this is...
Six miles long.
6 miles long. Okay, so you're talking about a kind of size as the comet we think hit the Earth at the end of the Cretaceous period and was responsible for the death of the dinosaurs. Okay, so something like 10 kilometers in size, 6 miles more or less, right? When that thing hits the ground, the first thing that happens is it builds a crater, right? And so you get what they call the transient crater, which is the thing that happens immediately after impact. So it comes in, it slams the Earth. It makes a crater that's going to be many times the size of the thing that's hitting this. So 10-kilometer body is going to generate a crater that's 40 or 50 kilometers wide, right, around us. And we can see evidence of that if we go and look at the Chicxulub crater. Looks like that sort of size. In fact, it's even bigger than that. And that's what people are looking at that thinking, okay, this could be the impact site of that particular impactor. So you build this thing, smashes in, makes this big crater. The crater itself is then unstable and just kind of falls in. And so you end up with a slightly smaller crater than the thing you initially built, which is what they call the transient crater. It lasts like, you know, minutes or seconds. Boom. And so you fill it in with rubble, and then that's your big impact site. And then you've done that. Boom. You now are trying to get rid of all that energy from the impact. And again, another sort of nuclear type explosion. You generate a huge fireball right in the center of this thing. You're hitting a shockwave that's going all around the planet. So you can see this big wave of stuff. And then you've got this really hot, concentrated fireball of energy. It's so hot, the energy can't really escape for a while. So you've got the shockwave going out first, and then a whole bunch of energy in here. And then finally, the fireball expands big enough that the energy can escape. Very much like how it was in the beginning of the universe. It's like the beginning of the universe in microcosm. And then it finally gets big enough that the energy can escape, and the energy starts to sweep behind the shockwave. So you get like a pressure shockwave. So the atmosphere is going, oh, ouch, I've been hit by something really hard. And so that spreads out. And so you get the initial shockwave, which will, you know, level buildings and do all kinds of horrible damage. And then you get the radiation shockwave that comes behind it as well, which also damages buildings, but brings all the harmful energy and stuff that we think about when we talk about like a nuclear.
It's almost like a strategic attack, isn't it? It's like, clear the way, and then here's the damage.
And then here's the rest. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So just to go back to the plot. So essentially what happens is the smaller 1.5 mile one makes impact.
Yeah.
Lands down in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
Creating mega tsunamis up to 3,500 feet. And they essentially blow up the 6 mile long section with a suicide mission, because they fly into the middle of it and they blow it all up with nuclear weapons.
Okay.
So they essentially pull a slightly different Armageddon.
Yeah.
By blowing themselves up, that breaks it then up into small enough pieces that it burns up on atmosphere. But you're still taking that hit from a 1.5 mile long. Yeah.
So that's 1.5 miles. So you're talking like basically a 1 kilometer body. So you're at the kind of the boundary of saying, okay, we are in jeopardy as a species.
Yeah.
Right. It's just on that and no more. And it's making entry into the ocean as well. So the same thing's going to happen that I described before. It's going to make a big impact crater, but instead of in the rock, it's going to be in the water. And so it's going to clear out a huge section of water, and then the water has to go somewhere. And so it just starts to spread. So some of it will start to spread and make big waves. Some of it will collapse back, and you'll get basically like switchbacks. So it'll come in and switch back, and then so you get the main wave, and then you get followed by a wave behind it, and the energy in the explosion is going to then drive the waves as well. So you get like all sorts of things generating different kinds of waves.
Okay.
So that sounds to me more like a realistic depiction of how we might cope with what's going on. And getting rid of the like a 6 mile body with a nuclear explosion is much more likely than a 1,000 kilometer body.
Yeah.
So Michael Bay clearly needs to like, you know, tone it down a little bit and like maybe keep his masculinity in check.
People might be saying that for years, then it's still not happening.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Look at the Transformers.
Yeah, he's still crapping on everyone's favourite franchises.
But then we sort of come to back to this initial plan that they have in that movie, because in Armageddon they don't really do anything other than let's just blow it up. They have other plans. Like they're blowing up the asteroid is part of multiple plans, because another plan is, and a lot of the drama comes from putting people into underground bunkers.
Mm.
Now, I'm pretty certain that the Earth is quite solid.
Yes.
Now, if you drop a 1 mile long, 2 mile long, 8 mile long, 9 mile long, whatever it is at the start of this movie, when you're dropping like a 7 mile long comet onto the world, that's going to cause things to break, things to take an impact. That impact is going to have an effect on the structure of the world. How effective is going to be hiding under the ground that's about to take a massive punch to the face going to be?
Well, so one of the things that is going to happen is clearly you're going to get a lot of seismic activity as the Earth basically rings like a bell after being smacked by this thing, right?
That's a great way of putting it.
Well, that's what it is. It's like... Like, exactly. You have to think of a gong being smashed, and the Earth is like the gong getting smashed. And so, yeah, you're going to have to make sure that whatever you build is going to be capable of dealing with that. So one of the tricky things you're going to have to decide is how deep do you want to go? You know, obviously, if you go too deep, then you... Well, so there's certain depths that seismic activity is going to end up being stronger at, so you don't want to avoid those levels. But you also don't want to be too close to the surface in case there's, you know, radiation and fallout, and so you've got to try and pick your position correctly. So,
is there a sweet spot in your expertise?
St. Andrews.
we'll go to the secret bunker. So it's not clear to me, off the top of my head, where this sort of the best site would be. Basically, you need to be a seismologist to know. But you're going to have to think about that. You're going to have to know roughly what's coming to hit you, how much activity you're going to expect, and where you expect the activity to be. If you're far enough away from the site, I don't see why it wouldn't be possible to survive in bunkers. Your issue is going to be the issues you always have with, like, a nuclear event of any kind, which is, do you have enough food and clean water and breathable air? And how long do you expect to last? And then you've got the things that take years to kind of sort themselves out, because you're going to throw a lot of dust into the air, just like a nuclear winter, and you're going to have to worry about the fact that you have to try and grow crops and, you know, sustain the cycle of harvest and all that kind of thing. And you might struggle with that. So, yeah, build a bunker. It's not a bad idea, right?
Get deep enough.
But pick your depth carefully and be prepared for the fact that, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Build lots of bunkers,
yeah,
right? Because, you know, you may only have one bunker that survives the impact, and that could be the entire cradle of humanity.
So take your favourite child with you, but put your other child in.
Let's not get into that.
Yeah, really. Let's just gently sidestep that.
I'm just thinking that. I wouldn't mind being a size smaller, just, you know?
Anyway, so let's come out of the fantasy a little bit and look at actual real world applications and options. Like, if you can't go down,
yeah,
in this situation, the only other option is, again, we're getting out here, getting off planet. Yeah. Now we've hit a bit of a stall with extraplanetary trips at the moment, I feel. And obviously this being, we're actually recording very close to the anniversary of the first moon landing.
So the first moon landing would have occurred today,
yeah,
as we record this.
That is
50 years ago.
Genuinely ridiculously coincidental.
It really is. We did not plan this at all. But it's a really nice fact, yeah. So we have hit a bit of a stall.
Yeah. So, I mean, in realistic, obviously, you want to look at various options. If we have a situation where we're like, yeah, we need to abandon the planet because there are various other reasons, like, I mean, let's not get into climate change and all that, because that's going to be another thing that's going to cause problems. But if we are in a situation where we need to leave the planet quickly,
yeah,
what is going to be the best option? Like, I've spoken to you about this before, on Drunken Evenings, and I've spoken to other people, and we've had the same conversation. It's like,
yeah,
obviously, we don't make use of the moon these days. Like, to get off the planet, we're stuck in a situation where we're trying to overcome things like gravity.
Yes.
So, like, I said, why don't we have a moon base? Why don't we have a proper space station we can use to launch space travel from?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're in an interesting period here because you're right. We've spent 50 years not really exploiting our potential to go to other planetary bodies. We've been very good at doing things in low Earth orbit. We've spent a lot of time kind of consolidating knowledge and asking ourselves difficult questions about, okay, if you spend a long time outside of the Earth's atmosphere in low gravity or no gravity environments, what happens to the body, right? And these are kind of big, sensible, but in some respects quite boring questions that you've got to figure out, right? Because no one's bothered about, like, what their bone density is when they go to the moon. They want to go to the moon, right? They don't care about whether they're going to have, you know, arthritis or they're going to have heart problems when they get there.
Just want to bounce about.
You know? You just want to go out there and enjoy yourself, right? That's the thing that we all think about.
Yeah, fantasize about these trips. Golf balls, you know, create some satellites.
Yeah, exactly.
Put a real flag there.
Yeah. Yes, there is a real flag there. And so a lot of sort of scientific research has been focused on that. And the desire to, like, put people onto the moon has been kind of allayed by the fact that we can actually put machines on the moon that can do a lot of things that we want them to do for scientific reasons. Like we can put a rover on Mars or on the moon or, you know, quite a lot of other places. So NASA has just approved a mission to go back to Saturn's moon Titan and to literally fly in its atmosphere with a drone. It's just really cool. So
look for Thanos.
It's inevitable.
So, you know, Titan is really interesting because it's the only moon in the solar system with a thick atmosphere. And in some respects, it looks a lot like the early Earth did in terms of its atmosphere, like the atmospheric composition, the hazes and all that kind of stuff. So some people say that one of the best sites for extraterrestrial life could be Titan. And we're going to go there and fly about and take samples, which is really cool. So there's that kind of drive to do things without people. But the real reason that people put people on these bodies is not because of scientific exploration. It's because of politics, right? You know, I mean, Apollo was born out of desire to make sure that Americans were on the moon first and not the Soviets. And we're seeing evidence of that space race starting to kick into gear again. And like, you know, the big three making power plays and saying, right, I want to be here first and do this thing first. And so I think the space race might start up again properly. And there's a lot more private interest as well. As like an extra factor.
The private interest seems to sort of, where previously was political, I feel like it's moving more towards that sort of political, like even almost financial benefits of getting off the planet.
Right. So I think like private entities are getting there thinking we can make a lot of money. Yeah. And then the big political organizations are saying, well, can we exploit your desire for money to make us look good? Exactly. So you have companies like SpaceX now taking on NASA contracts and, you know, this kind of interrelationship between public and private and different goals, but ultimately trying to achieve the same thing, which is getting people back onto the moon, onto Mars for the first time, you know, actually exploring the solar system and establishing manned bases.
Now, I know there was talk that, I can't remember if this is entirely true, China having a base on the moon, on the dark side of the moon.
So China currently has a rover on the far side of the moon. They have a telescope on the far side of the moon, which is amazing, right? So the reason you want to put stuff on that side,
because you're looking out,
is that basically you can keep the Earth behind you,
and you're starting.
You know how right fast the moon.
Yeah, so it's not going to be on the dark side all the time because of
I imagine
change.
It's like when people are behind me in the cinema, like you're not having to look past my head.
Well, it's just if you're looking in the radio, for example, right, and you want to like look at the universe in the radio, and you've got this really noisy radio source behind you, which is us, this podcast, TV, all the stuff that we like belch out into the universe. If you can put a whole like planetary body in between you and all that interference, then suddenly the universe becomes nice and quiet, and you can study that, you know, distant black hole spitting out energy, or you can study Jupiter, like the loudest radio body in the solar system, you know, and you can do all kinds of science you couldn't do before. They can do it because they've managed to get to the far side. And, you know, they're not going to stop there. I think they will want to start putting permanent established areas there where they may not be people, but someday they might be people, you know. There are lots of plans to try and find ways to establish outposts that people can live there, and they can, you know, drink the local water, and they can produce food. They can turn the lunar soil into something that resembles terrestrial soil and start growing crops.
Having those bases on the moon or in space floating around, almost like sort of your Deep Space Nine-esque sort of space station ports, almost.
Yes.
Like, one of the biggest issues that that is faced by humans trying to get off Earth is Earth's not wanting to let go.
Yes.
Like, we are stuck in this needy relationship where you're like, no, don't go.
I never thought of the Earth as like a codependent, but yeah, you're kind of right.
Yeah. I don't know what you hear, but you can't leave.
Stay, please stay.
So, like, surely, like, again, it... having that situation where you can essentially get off the planet and not have to deal with the ridiculous gravity to then be able to fire off research missions or flight missions or whatever, because to get off the moon is easy because you just push it.
Yes.
And that's it. The trick at the moment is finding that efficient way of getting off Earth.
Yes.
And is that where we start talking about things like space ladders?
So, yeah, so the space elevator is an idea that's been around for a long time.
Sorry.
Space, I mean, to be honest,
it would be fucking tiring.
It would take you a long time.
I'm sure they put plenty of stops, like, I mean, no seat.
I got knackered coming up to here.
Yeah, I would be like, I get like 3 steps up, I'd be like, yeah, no, you guys go back.
Yeah. I'll see space one day.
Yeah. So the space elevator thing is a concept that's been around for a long time. The idea basically is that you trail out a bunch of cable that's attached to the Earth at one end, and the far end is a geostationary orbit, which is the point in the orbit whereas you orbit around the Earth, the same point below you is kind of in focus. So you can basically have a long piece of cable that you can roll things up and down, and the minute you get to the top, you've solved all the problems of trying to get out of this needy relationship. And you're ready to go where
you want. What can I say? I'm breaking ground with science here.
Yeah, I've never heard it described like that, but it's kind of right.
I'll write my own book. It'd be great. It'll be a pamphlet in crayon.
So but I don't need the Earth anymore.
So if you're doing it that way, where you're almost like pulling yourself along,
yeah,
you don't need that same force to get out of the atmosphere.
So how we get out of the atmosphere currently is we fire off a rocket, which allows us to accelerate to a very high speed. And so getting to that high speed is enough to basically say that when the rocket stops firing, we've got enough velocity to keep going and get ourselves out. What you could do with the space elevator is just go at like 30 miles an hour and just keep going, right? And so a constant acceleration, you're going to keep going and keep going, and eventually you get out. So it's not as like exciting and dramatic as a rocket launch. But it might take you longer to get to orbit, but you get there at the cost of, say, like driving a car across country, I mean, rather than launching tons of material with really expensive fuel.
It's essentially a fraction of the energy being expended for that one big burst to go...
Yeah,
and just literally rip yourself free of gravity.
Like getting a train to Paris rather than flying.
Yeah, you can. It's like the Eurostar, but to outer space.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then once you're there, essentially launching from space when you're in space...
is a lot easier.
Because there's no gravity, so you just go, off I go.
Yeah, so you're out of the sort of the deep part of the Earth's gravitational well, and So there's some plans by... again, some of NASA's contractors to try and develop what they call the Lunar Gateway. And so the idea is that it's halfway to getting to the elevator, this idea of like doing the stuff in low gravity where it's cheaper. And so what they would do is they would build basically a space station that orbits the Earth. And that would be a stopping off point for missions to the moon. So you'd get your rocket, you would launch your stuff to the gateway. And the gateway is this bit where you kind of basically prepare for the next step. Because the biggest issue with Apollo is what they had to do. Everything for the entire mission was on the rocket. So they launched, got to orbit, and then they got to the point where the rocket itself had detached, and they had the command module and the lunar module. And what they had to do to basically get everything to work was detach the lunar module from the command module, turn it around, well, turn the command module around, and reattach. And that's bloody hard, right? Nerves of steel stuff. Like, and a lot of it was computer guided, but the final touch was from the person.
But this is also computer guided, like back in the era of the Atari.
Well, I mean, it was computer guided in the sense
Atari, was it not?
Yeah, it was pre-Atari. It was like this is you're talking so computers the size of a room.
So you can download the source code from the Apollo computers. It's on the internet, and it's like I think it's 50 kilobytes.
Yeah,
or something like that. It's mental.
That would have maxed out the computers back then.
Now, if you think like that's like a fraction of a text message, and inside that is all of the guidance and all of the systems checking and all the alarms that get triggered if something goes wrong, all of that is controlled by this tiny, tiny piece of source code. And then the rest of it is just the people involved. And, you know, so at several points during the Apollo 11 mission, the computer just kind of flipped out because it was trying to process too much data at once. And so, you know, the pilots at the time, so Collins during the lunar module's command module realignment, and then Armstrong during the landing basically had to take control and say, well, sorry computer, you're too busy thinking, I'll just go and land this thing while we're talking.
Yeah, because that was the other thing, it's like he nearly goosed it, didn't he?
Well, he had seconds of fuel left before they had to call and abort, and he managed it, and like nerves of absolute steel, like this is why they call it the right stuff, you know. It's amazing. So yeah, all these different things that happened during Apollo, and we've had a lot of time to sort of digest those and think about them, and they're thinking now, well, actually it's probably better to have a space station in orbit that's designed purely to get ourselves to the point of, right, you've left the Earth, or you've left the deepest part of the well, let's now prepare you for your lunar mission, and we'll store a lot of this stuff up here so we can run lots of missions from the same
and it's easier to transport stuff because it's just going up and down this lift.
Well, so the gateway itself doesn't require the elevator at this point, right? It's just going to be a space station in orbit. If you had the elevator attached to a gateway object like that, then yeah.
Game changer.
Absolute game changer.
Takeaway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so it's... yeah.
Are we going to just eat?
I've just got an image of like the elevator and it's just a couple of slats and it's just like Domino's pizza going just outside. An empty box going down the
side. Imagine that, like, Houston, yeah? Is Nando's still open? I do like the idea of this like sort of geostationary sort of aircraft carrier in a way. I think that's
what you see.
Mm-hmm. But the next question would be, would you then develop planetary defences for situations like comets? Not necessarily the Armageddon sized ones, but smaller ones.
Yes.
And just be like, oh, no, you're not getting... Where you go, you know.
So you can go online and you can read NASA's studies of what they call asteroid mitigation, which is basically if you find something and you know it's coming, you know, maybe you've plotted the orbital course and you think, okay, I think in the next 30 years that's going to become, you know, potentially hazardous. What do you do? And there are certain things you can do to, yeah, maybe try and nudge the asteroid. So the earlier you find it, the earlier you can change its course, the more likely you can to change its course away from us.
Suddenly, Jupiter disappears. Whoops.
This is the thing that you sort of wonder. Like, rather than blowing stuff up, would it be like a logical way to try and, like, if you can send like rockets with drones and stuff out to this asteroid and get the drones to essentially line up along one side and just like fire and just... literally push it off onto a different...
Iron Man pushing the ferry together.
That's a variant of one of the missions that's proposed. And the idea is that instead of having a bunch of drones, what you do is you land something on the surface and its entire job is to dig up the asteroid and spit it back. And so using Newton's third law, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So you fire something out this way and the asteroid moves the other way. So if you fire enough things out this way, you can push the asteroid that way, and it's just like a very slow nudge.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's one idea. You just put a bunch of these things down, and you start spitting bits of the asteroid to the right, and the asteroid moves to the left.
Like a little mole machine.
Yeah, basically, you just drill stuff, right? And there's where having drilling people on an asteroid is actually useful.
Do you know what? That is an amazing cycle all the way back round to the...
Yeah, so we can get right to the beginning. And yeah, there's lots of ideas like that where you're basically just trying to encourage the asteroid to move in one direction or the other. You know, some ideas are quite interesting. So if you've got a smaller body, what you do is you paint one side white and one side black. And so you use solar radiation to basically push your object in one direction, so either by reflection or by absorption.
Decorators into space.
Yeah, so that's Armageddon 2, right?
That's Armageddon 2.
Where they send
have the drillers anymore. We're gonna send the send the painters.
Yeah, we're a team of 10 elite painters.
I'm gonna train them up to teach astronauts to paint.
Nah, shut up.
Because they've done a piss poor job of the painting.
Yeah,
that's.
And the final idea, which I like, is really crazy, and they call it the gravity tractor. And basically, I mean, this is very much pushing our abilities to do stuff. And it's probably science fiction at this point. So if you've got a big body that's about to head towards Earth, the way to change its direction is to put another big body next to it and just let its gravity basically pull it away.
Oh, I watched that in Star Trek Discovery Season 2.
Oh, there you go.
It's a really good...
That's right. Right
to fiction. That's right. There you go. Is it Dark Matter Asteroid?
Yeah, Dark Matter Asteroid.
Boom. There you go. See? So that's the gravity factor. That's a serious NASA proposal. Obviously, like, taking into account the fact that we need to be able to move large objects and we can't do that yet. But imagine if you could just nudge like a big object next to it, and just the closer you put it, the more the gravitational attraction.
It's an amazing episode. Do go if you can, go on Netflix, watch Star Trek Discovery, both series. Season 2 is a perfect example of exactly what you'll see, what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Where they essentially use a very dense object to drag things out of the way of something, and it's a... yeah, again, excellent. Thank you. I'm really pleased that I remembered that.
Good stuff.
I think we've had a good old...
I have one more question.
You have one more question?
Yeah, sure. See how we talked earlier about the flag on the moon?
Uh-huh.
Have you actually observed... I mean, I've seen pictures of the flag on the moon, but a cynic could be like, oh, they could be doctored. Have you yourself actually observed the flag on the moon? Because that would be really cool.
Have I personally seen it?
Yes.
I've not seen it. I've seen other... satellites of the moon observe the landing site and they can see the flag. Mm-hmm. As far as I can tell. What's interesting is that the flag used to have stars and stripes, but it doesn't anymore because over time, essentially, the flag has been heavily irradiated and so it's lost all its colour. It's been bleached. Yeah.
We surrender.
It's a white flag. Yeah, I never thought of it like that.
Aliens come in and we're like, it's okay, we won't fight back.
Yeah, it's fine. We're like, dude, what's that white flag mean?
Maybe that was the plan all along. Yeah. Oh, they're already surrendering.
Could you imagine if the Russians got up there first and just graffitied it?
But you can see the landing legs of the Apollo missions. You can see the footprints they left on the moon. You can see the tire tracks of the rovers. Like, if you believe the lunar landing is a hoax, there are lots of resources that you can go and you can see that it's really not a hoax. They really did it.
Yeah, and I feel
and
bad.
If you wonder why Buzz Aldrin punched that guy in the face, come on.
Nobody.
If I was Buzz Aldrin and someone told me that the greatest thing I'd ever done in my life didn't happen, I would punch them in the face.
Your book never came out.
Yeah, your book's not real. Yeah.
Awesome. No, that's been a good one. Any further?
No, I've got I'm pretty much tapped out. I think I've really enjoyed this.
This is
revisited a conversation that me and Duncan had many years ago in Edinburgh on a very drunken evening.
We had a lot less pints this time. I think
that
helps.
Yeah, a lot less pints. Well, I'm a lot tired now. My tolerance for alcohol is considerably lower, but this has been one of the ones I've really been looking forward to.
Here's where I'll test if you guys have been thinking ahead. Forgan, you want to sign off?
Oh, God, okay. Yeah, I'll sign off. How do we do that again?
Stu, where can people find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter at bardyogre.com. No, is that at bardyogre?
Take two.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at bardyogre, and that's really about it. I don't really post very much, but.
And Forgan, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter as well, and I'm at DH4GAN. That's DH4GAN.
Excellent. Cool. You can also find us at Sci-Fi Podcast on Twitter or fcpod.net/thescienceoffiction. Stu, Forgan, thanks. That's been a good one.
It's been a really good one.
Yeah.
Good way to start the season two, I think.
We'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You've been listening to another great podcast from the Fair City Podcast Network, a group dedicated to connecting and developing podcasts. Check out fcpod.net. More great podcasts and content.